The Alchemy of Finance by George Soros. Part 1. Theory. Have you ever wondered whether the financial markets operate on logic, or if they're simply an elaborate game of perception? In Part 1, Theory, Soros dismantles the comforting belief that markets naturally find balance, introducing his theory of reflexivity, the idea that investors don't merely react to reality, they shape it. Their expectations and biases influence prices, and those price movements in turn reshape economic fundamentals, creating cycles of booms and crashes. The traditional idea of equilibrium is nothing more than a myth. Markets are driven by flawed human judgment, and understanding this is the key to anticipating financial trends. If you're prepared to see the markets in an entirely new way, continue reading for a deeper dive into the core concepts of Part 1 Theory. The Theory of Reflexivity. Most people believe that markets function like a well-oiled machine, naturally balancing supply and demand to reach an ideal price. However, what if that wasn't true? What if the very act of participating in the market altered its outcome? And this is where George Soros's concept of reflexivity comes in. He argues that markets don't simply reflect reality, they shape it, as investors make decisions based on their own perceptions, but those perceptions, in turn, influence market conditions, creating a feedback loop where prices move not because of cold, hard facts, but due to the collective emotions, biases, and expectations of market participants, creating cycles of booms and busts. Reflexivity explains why bubbles inflate beyond reason, and why crashes feel like freefalls. Imagine a stock price soaring simply because people believe it will keep rising. As investors pile in, their belief strengthens, pushing the price even higher. But when sentiment shifts, the same reflexive loop drags prices down. Markets aren't efficient calculators of value. They are battlegrounds of perception, and understanding this gives traders and investors an edge. It allows them to see beyond traditional theories and recognize that the financial world is driven by waves of confidence and fear rather than pure logic. Reflexivity in the stock market. The stock market is the ultimate playground of human psychology, as prices don't just reflect a company's performance, they actively influence it. When investors believe a stock will rise, they buy more, boosting its price, which makes companies look stronger, allowing them to raise capital, invest in expansion, and deliver the very success that investors predicted, creating a self-fulfilling cycle. However, the opposite is also true. When fear takes over, stock prices fall, making companies appear weaker, and investors panic, selling off shares, which further damages the company's ability to grow. This is why market trends tend to overshoot in both directions. Reflexivity turns small shifts in sentiment into major price swings. History is full of reflexive stock market cycles. Think about the dot-com bubble, where optimism about internet companies drove valuations to absurd heights, and the higher they climbed, the more people believed they were unstoppable. Then, as reality failed to match expectations, the bubble burst and prices collapsed. The same reflexive forces that created the boom accelerated the bust. Soros teaches us that stock prices aren't just numbers. They are stories in motion, shaped by investors' beliefs. Those who understand this can ride these waves, while those who blindly trust in, quote, market fundamentals are often left behind. Reflexivity in the currency market. Currency markets operate in a world of shifting perceptions, and unlike stocks, where value is tied to earnings, currencies are constantly judged against each other. Traders don't merely react to economic data, they anticipate it. So if investors believe the euro will strengthen, they buy it, pushing its price higher, which reinforces the perception that it's a strong currency, attracting even more buyers. And this self-reinforcing cycle continues until something, perhaps a sudden policy shift or economic crisis, shatters the illusion, sending prices into reverse. This effect became even more pronounced when fixed exchange rates gave way to floating rates in the 1970s. Suddenly, the market, not central banks, dictated currency values, and speculators gained immense power, able to drive currency trends simply by anticipating them. For instance, Soros himself famously broke the Bank of England in 1992. By betting against the British pound, he triggered a reflexive spiral. His actions convinced others to sell, further weakening the pound until the government was forced to abandon its defense. Reflexivity teaches us that in the currency market, perception is often more powerful than reality, and those who grasp this can anticipate the major shifts before they happen. The credit and regulatory cycle. The credit cycle resembles an economic heartbeat, oscillating between booms and busts, impacting the financial world in ways most people hardly notice. When credit expands, banks eagerly lend, businesses flourish, and asset prices soar. It all feels unstoppable, until it isn't. The very same credit that fuels growth can turn into a burden when optimism wanes. As borrowing decreases, asset values plummet, and suddenly, what seemed like wealth vanishes. This is the harsh rhythm of financial markets. Governments and central banks try to intervene, adjusting interest rates and injecting liquidity to mitigate the impact. However, their interventions often extend the cycle artificially, postponing the inevitable correction. Instead of a gradual adjustment, the system accumulates pressure until the bubble finally bursts, leading to a swift and painful collapse. Regulation acts as both hero and villain in this perpetual financial drama. Following a crisis, governments hastily impose stricter rules, aiming to prevent another disaster. Initially, these regulations restore stability, but as time passes and memories fade, pressure builds to ease restrictions. Markets need freedom to grow, they argue, and soon, deregulation spurs another wave of speculation. This continuous back and forth between control and chaos creates an unending cycle. Look at history. The roaring financial expansion of the 1980s, the dot-com boom, the housing bubble of the 2000s. Each followed the same pattern: explosive growth, regulatory complacency, and then crash. The cycle is as old as finance itself, a battle between risk and restraint, where the players change, but the game remains the same. Part 2. Historical Perspective. Financial markets don't merely move in random waves. As history demonstrates, they follow patterns, repeating the same cycles of boom, crisis, and recovery. In Part 2, Historical Perspective, I delve deeply into major economic events to uncover the forces that truly drive financial instability. From the international debt crisis to the evolution of banking and the growing concentration of financial power, it becomes evident that markets aren't simply reacting to reality, they're shaping it. By examining the past through the lens of reflexivity, we begin to see how speculation, policy decisions, and human psychology combine to create the financial world we inhabit today. If you're ready to explore the hidden connections between past crises and future risks, continue reading for a closer look at Part 2, Historical Perspective, The International Debt Problem. Imagine a country drowning in debt, desperately borrowing more just to pay off previous loans. This was the brutal reality for many developing nations in the late 20th century. Banks, eager to lend, poured billions into these economies, convinced that endless growth would make repayment a breeze. Yet reality struck hard. Commodity prices plunged, exports weakened, and suddenly, debt that once seemed manageable became an unbearable burden. Governments scrambled to stay afloat, but every attempt to fix the situation, whether through restructuring or financial aid, only delayed the inevitable. The debt ballooned, not because of reckless spending, but because the global financial system had set these nations up for failure. The Baker Plan, designed to stabilize struggling economies, was little more than a bandage on a deep wound. As it failed to address the core issue, there was simply no way to pay back what was owed. The crisis exposed the harsh truth about global finance. Once a country fell into debt, escaping was nearly impossible. Latin America was the hardest hit, with nations trapped in a cycle of borrowing just to meet interest payments. The proposed solution involved economic reforms and tighter policies, however, even those came with a catch. Developed nations imposed trade restrictions that prevented these struggling economies from selling their goods and growing their way out of debt. Instead of relief, they were handed more obstacles. The result was a never-ending financial trap, where debt was not just an economic issue, but a political weapon that kept entire regions under the control of international lenders. The collective system of lending. Picture a world where banks eagerly lend billions to developing nations, convinced they are fueling progress. Initially, it seems like a golden era. Countries gain access to funds for infrastructure, industry, and modernization, while lenders rake in interest payments. Yet, beneath the surface, something is off. The debts keep growing, and soon, repayments become a struggle. Rather than pulling back, banks double down, believing that as long as everyone keeps lending, the system will stay afloat. This is the essence of the collective system of lending, a financial safety net designed not to help struggling nations recover, but to ensure that creditors don't face massive losses. International organizations like the IMF and World Bank step in, offering new loans to repay old ones, creating the illusion that everything is under control. It's a high-stakes game of musical chairs, where no one wants to be the last one standing when the music stops. Nonetheless, Soros sees through the illusion. He argues that this system doesn't solve the problem. It simply postpones disaster. By continually refinancing bad debts, lenders avoid immediate collapse. Yet the economic foundations of borrowing nations remain weak. These countries aren't using new loans for development. They're using them to pay off past mistakes. Meanwhile, banks take on even greater risks, assuming they'll be bailed out if things go wrong. The result: a cycle of dependency, where debt piles up, growth stagnates, and financial crises become inevitable. Soros warns that unless the world confronts the flaws of this system, the next economic meltdown won't just be a possibility. It will be a certainty. Reagan's Imperial Circle. The 1980s in America felt like an era of unstoppable economic dominance. The dollar was strong, the stock market was booming, and foreign investors couldn't get enough of U.S. assets. This was Reagan's Imperial Circle, a self-sustaining loop where high interest rates attracted capital, strengthening the economy, which in turn kept the dollar robust and foreign money flowing. It seemed like an impeccable system. Yet, beneath this golden age of prosperity was a ticking time bomb. The entire cycle relied on continuous borrowing and faith in the dollar. If that faith wavered, even slightly, the whole system could collapse. And, as history has demonstrated, markets are driven as much by psychology as by actual economic fundamentals. Trouble started brewing when rising deficits and debt servicing costs raised concerns. Investors began questioning whether the U.S. could maintain such massive borrowing without repercussions. If they withdrew their money, the dollar would weaken, and interest rates would skyrocket to compensate, crushing economic growth. This wasn't just a theoretical risk. It was a genuine danger that policymakers chose to ignore. The Reagan-era boom wasn't built on true economic strength, but on an illusion of infinite capital inflows. And the longer the government postponed a correction, the more dramatic and painful the eventual reckoning would be. Evolution of the banking system. Banking in America once followed a simple rule: protect deposits, make responsible loans, and ensure stability. However, the 1980s rewrote the playbook. Banks, confronted with soaring interest rates and an unstable financial landscape, abandoned caution and embraced risk. Traditional lending gave way to speculative investments, and institutions that had once been bastions of security now operated like high-stakes gamblers. Regulators, rather than reining them in, loosened restrictions, believing that market forces would keep everything in check. Thus, what ensued was a wave of financial engineering, where banks sought profits not through traditional lending, but through complex, high-risk maneuvers that few fully understood. Mergers and acquisitions reshaped the industry, consolidating power into fewer hands. The idea was that bigger banks meant stronger banks, but in reality, it created institutions that were too big to fail. When crises hit, these giants could take the entire system down with them. The irony was that the very policies meant to stabilize the financial sector were setting the stage for future disasters. Moreover, the deregulation of the 1980s granted banks unprecedented freedom, but with freedom came recklessness. Consequently, the financial system was no longer just about banking. It had morphed into a high-risk, high-reward casino, and sooner or later, someone was destined to lose. The oligopolization of America. Corporate America in the 1980s was akin to a battlefield where only the biggest and most ruthless survived. Mergers and leveraged buyouts were not merely business strategies. They were weapons in a war for market dominance. One by one, small and mid-sized companies were absorbed into corporate behemoths, creating industries dominated by a handful of powerful players. This wasn't just capitalism at work, it was the deliberate shaping of an economic landscape where competition was crushed and control was concentrated at the top. The promise was efficiency and growth, but what emerged was something closer to an oligopoly, where a few corporations dictated market terms, pricing, and even government policy. Initially, investors loved it. Stock prices soared, corporate profits exploded, and Wall Street cheered every new mega merger. However, beneath the surface, cracks were forming. Companies took on massive debt to finance takeovers, betting that endless growth would keep them profitable. Yet, what happens when interest rates rise? When consumer demand slows? The system, once seen as unstoppable, suddenly appeared fragile. The government's hands-off approach allowed these corporate titans to grow unchecked, yet as the economy became increasingly dominated by a few key players, the risks of collapse became greater. The American economy had transformed, not into a land of free competition, but into a game controlled by a select few, where the stakes had never been higher. Part 3. The Real-Time Experiment. There's a big difference between having a theory and risking real money to prove it. In Part 3, The Real-Time Experiment, I move my ideas out of the realm of speculation and into the financial battlefield, tracking every decision, win, and loss while navigating the markets. This isn't merely about predicting trends. It's about understanding how perception itself moves prices, how narratives create financial realities, and how rapidly things can spiral out of control. Throughout this journey, I uncover surprising truths about market behavior and the hidden forces that drive it. If you want to see what transpires when theory meets the real world, and whether reflexivity can truly outsmart the markets, continue reading for a detailed breakdown of Part 3, The Real-Time Experiment. The Starting Point, August 1985. Every great experiment begins with a hypothesis, and for George Soros, the real-time experiment he embarked on in August 1985 was about testing the power of reflexivity in financial markets. At that time, global markets were in a precarious position, with the U.S. dollar soaring for years, making American exports less competitive and fueling economic imbalances. Meanwhile, high interest rates attracted foreign capital, reinforcing the dollar's strength while weakening the real economy. Soros suspected that this trend was unsustainable, believing that the U.S. government would soon be compelled to intervene to weaken the dollar, thereby reversing the financial dynamics that had defined the past few years. The goal of this experiment was to track market behavior in real time and assess whether his reflexivity theory could successfully predict market movements. Nevertheless, this wasn't merely an academic exercise. It was a high-stakes investment strategy. Soros began positioning his fund accordingly, expecting a shift in monetary policy that would trigger a decline in the dollar and a rally in other asset classes. He meticulously documented his thought process, tracking both his successes and misjudgments, and this approach gave him an edge over traditional investors who relied purely on economic fundamentals. By monitoring how investor sentiment and policy decisions fed into market behavior, Soros aimed to prove that markets were not efficient, but deeply influenced by cycles of perception and reality. The experiment was set, and now it was time to put theory into action. Phase 1, August 1985 to December 1985. The first few months of the experiment validated Soros's instincts, as in September 1985, the world's leading economies gathered in New York and signed the Plaza Accord, an agreement to actively weaken the U.S. dollar, which was the trigger Soros had been waiting for. As expected, the dollar began to decline sharply, confirming his belief that market movements were driven not just by economic fundamentals, but by collective expectations and policy decisions. And the stock market surged, bonds rallied, and international... The first phase of the experiment proved that a major market shift could be anticipated by understanding how investor psychology and policy actions reinforced each other. Nevertheless, success didn't mean smooth sailing. Market reactions were erratic, And even though Soros was right about the broader trend, there were moments of self-doubt, and the reflexive process worked both ways. Just as investor optimism had once strengthened the dollar, panic and uncertainty now accelerated its decline. Soros navigated this turbulence by adjusting his positions dynamically, demonstrating that successful investing wasn't just about predicting the future, but adapting to constantly shifting narratives. By December, the data was clear, the theory of reflexivity was in full effect, and Soros's portfolio had benefited significantly from the unfolding market transformation. Control period, January 1986 to July 1986. Markets have a way of humbling even the most seasoned investors, and for George Soros, the first half of 1986 was a masterclass in unpredictability. The year began with a sharp drop in stocks and bonds, an unexpected shock that exposed the fragility of his positions. His portfolio, structured around an optimistic outlook, suddenly looked vulnerable. As panic set in, he adjusted selling bonds in a rush, only to regret it and buy them back too soon. Each move seemed to be a step behind the market's relentless swings. Meanwhile, his trades in foreign currencies and European stocks provided some relief, but the overall picture was one of frustration. It was a painful reminder that even with all the data, analysis, and experience, markets have a mind of their own. Outside the financial charts, global events added more uncertainty. A strong U.S. employment report signaled that interest rates might stay high, dashing hopes for a market-friendly rate cut. Geopolitical tensions flared, with Libya facing sanctions and rumors swirling about Arab investors pulling out of U.S. markets. Then came the changes in margin requirements for junk bonds, injecting fresh volatility into equities. Soros realized the euphoria that had been driving markets was built on shaky ground, making sudden downturns inevitable. The biggest lesson was that understanding market cycles is one thing. Timing them correctly is an entirely different challenge, even for a legendary investor. Phase 2, July 1986 to November 1986. By mid-1986, Soros was forced to rethink everything. The bullish momentum that had defined the previous years was now colliding with new risks. Most notably, the dramatic decline in oil prices. He suspected that this could trigger a deflationary spiral, undercutting the very growth that had been fueling the markets. This left him in an uncomfortable position. Should he stick with his original thesis of a long-lasting bull market or brace for an economic downturn? The uncertainty was exhausting. He hedged his bets, literally, by making adjustments to his portfolio, but a few missteps, including an ill-timed hedge before a trip to China, drained both capital and confidence. The pressure was building, and each trade carried more weight than the last. Despite his struggles, Soros wasn't about to sit on the sidelines. He took aggressive positions in government bond auctions, oil, and gold, yet not all of them paid off. His most successful move was a short position on the yen, which helped offset some of his other losses. By November, he had reshuffled his portfolio once again, focusing on long-term bonds and strategic currency trades, yet the period had taken a toll. The market had not behaved according to his expectations, and his theory of reflexivity, where perceptions shape reality, had been tested in ways he hadn't anticipated. The second phase of his experiment didn't end with triumph, but with a sobering truth. In the financial world, no amount of intelligence or strategy can fully tame the chaos. The conclusion, November 1986. By the end of 1986, Soros found himself reflecting on the most turbulent year of his career. His once clear vision of a historic bull market had been shaken, forcing him to confront a new reality. Markets don't move in clean, predictable cycles. Instead, they operate on the edge of collapse, constantly flirting with disaster before snapping back into place. This was a profound realization. He began to see financial systems as inherently unstable, always vulnerable, always in motion. The idea of a grand, inevitable boom followed by a predictable bust now seemed too simplistic. Instead, markets resembled a never-ending balancing act, with each crisis triggering interventions that delayed, but never truly resolved, the underlying risks. Looking ahead, Soros sensed that the next big economic shift wouldn't come from within the financial markets alone. It would be political. A newly empowered Democratic Congress signaled a potential move toward protectionism, which could disrupt global trade and shake market confidence. Meanwhile, fears of a worldwide recession loomed large, adding yet another layer of uncertainty. The real-time experiment hadn't given him a clear-cut answer about the future, but it had cemented one crucial lesson. The market is a battlefield, and survival depends on the ability to adapt. No theory, no matter how sophisticated, could fully predict the next move. The only certainty was uncertainty. Part 4. Evaluation. In Part 4, Evaluation of the Alchemy of Finance, George Soros invites us to see the market through a different lens, as this isn't just about numbers and charts. It's about how emotions, perceptions, and beliefs shape economic reality, and how much our expectations influence actual outcomes. Is it truly possible to predict market behavior, or are we caught in a perpetual game of uncertainty? With his signature provocative approach, Soros challenges the ability of economic science to provide definitive answers and delves into the magic and limitations of financial alchemy. If you want to explore his findings in depth and understand the impact of his famous real-time experiment, keep reading for a detailed breakdown of each section in this fascinating evaluation. The scope for financial alchemy, an evaluation of the experiment. George Soros set out to do something most investors wouldn't dare: test his own theories in real time. With billions of dollars at stake, his belief in reflexivity, the idea that markets are shaped not by pure logic, but by the perceptions and biases of investors, was put to the ultimate test. At first, it seemed unstoppable. In just 11 months, his quantum fund soared by an astonishing 126%, leaving traditional investors in the dust. The strategy was working. By anticipating how market participants would react rather than simply following economic fundamentals, he was able to ride trends before they fully formed. But then, just as quickly as things had gone right, they started going wrong. In the second phase of the experiment, his fund lost 2%, exposing the brutal reality of financial markets. No, this realization didn't shake Soros' confidence. It refined it. He wasn't trying to be a prophet. He was playing a game of constant adaptation. Unlike traditional investors who cling to rigid models, he embraced uncertainty, adjusting his positions based on how market psychology evolved. But here's where it gets interesting. Soros saw that markets themselves behave like giant, self-correcting experiments. Investors collectively form hypotheses about the future, act on them, and then the market either validates or destroys those beliefs. It's not a precise science, it's alchemy, a mix of logic, psychology, and unpredictability. The real lesson is that success in finance isn't about having the perfect forecast. It's about understanding the endless cycle of mistakes, corrections, and new opportunities. And those who master this art of financial alchemy are the ones who come out on top. The quandary of the social sciences. What if everything you believed about economics was based on a flawed assumption? Soros takes aim at a fundamental problem. As economists want to study human behavior the same way physicists study gravity, as if markets follow predictable laws. However, here's the twist. In finance, the observers are also participants, and their theories influence the markets they analyze, creating a reality where predictions can shape outcomes. Unlike natural sciences, where facts exist independently of human perception, economics is constantly shifting because of the way people react to information. And markets aren't rational machines. They're battlegrounds of emotions, expectations, and political decisions, making traditional economic models unreliable. Just because something worked in the past doesn't mean it will work again. Soros argues that the obsession with equilibrium is misleading, as real markets don't move in perfect balance. They swing between extremes, driven by fear and greed, and he believes that social sciences need a new approach. One that embraces uncertainty instead of ignoring it. Rather than treating people like predictable data points, economists should incorporate psychology, history, and even philosophy to understand how financial systems evolve. The challenge, he explains, is that economic theories don't just describe reality, they shape it. often with unintended consequences. By recognizing this, we can move beyond rigid models and develop a more flexible, real-world understanding of finance. The future of economics, according to Soros, isn't about perfect equations. It's about learning to navigate an unpredictable world. Part 5. Prescription. In Part 5, Prescription of the Alchemy of Finance, George Soros transitions from observation to action, shifting focus from merely analyzing market forces to asking, what can we do to fix the system? Should markets be left to their own devices, or does the world require stronger regulations? With his characteristic boldness, Soros challenges the notion that free markets inherently correct themselves, proposing radical solutions like the establishment of an international central bank to stabilize the global economy. He doesn't merely critique, he envisions a financial world that is both dynamic and resilient. But are his ideas practical, or are they simply ambitious dreams? Delve into the detailed breakdown of Part 5, Prescription, to explore his thought-provoking proposals and their potential impact on the future of finance. Free markets versus regulation. Markets are often seen as the ultimate problem solvers, effortlessly balancing supply and demand. However, what if that balance is an illusion? Soros challenges the widely held belief that markets are inherently rational and self-correcting. He argues that instead of stabilizing themselves, markets can become breeding grounds for speculation and bubbles. When investors act on biased perceptions, their collective behavior can amplify trends rather than correct them. This is how financial booms spiral out of control, only to collapse into devastating busts. The 2008 financial crisis is a prime example. Banks and investors fueled a housing bubble, convinced that prices were catastrophic. Yet does that mean we should hand full control to regulators? Not quite. Soros warns against excessive intervention, which can stifle innovation and slow economic growth. Instead, he advocates for a middle ground, a regulatory framework that acts as a safety net without suffocating financial dynamism. Smart regulations should anticipate risks, provide stability, and prevent reckless behavior without limiting healthy competition. Think of it like the rules of the road. Traffic lights don't stop people from driving, but they prevent chaos. The goal isn't to eliminate financial risk, but to manage it in a way that prevents crises. When markets operate within well toward an international central bank. Picture this. A financial crisis erupts in one country, but instead of triggering a global meltdown, it's swiftly contained. Markets remain steady. Currencies don't spiral out of control. And investors stay confident, which sounds ideal, doesn't it? That's precisely what Soros envisions with the creation of an international central bank. In the contemporary world, financial markets are more interconnected than ever. Yet monetary policies remain fragmented. Every central bank focuses on its own economy, frequently making decisions that send shockwaves across borders. The problem is evident. Without global coordination, financial crises spread like dominoes, taking down economies one by one. Soros asserts that a unified financial authority could prevent this by monitoring capital flows, stabilizing currencies, and providing emergency liquidity before a crisis spirals out of control. It wouldn't replace national central banks, but would serve as a stabilizing force, ensuring that financial markets don't become battlegrounds for speculative attacks and panic-driven sell-offs. Naturally, turning this idea into reality won't be straightforward, as countries fiercely protect their financial independence, and the idea of a global monetary authority sparks fears of losing control. Nonetheless, Soros warns that clinging to outdated structures will only lead to more frequent and devastating crises. Instead of constructing something entirely new, he suggests reforming and strengthening the International Monetary Fund, IMF, giving it the power to act as a genuine global financial regulator. With the appropriate framework transparency, strong governance, and clear economic policies, an international central bank could bring order to an increasingly chaotic system. The question is no longer whether we need it, but how much longer we can afford to wait will the world take action before the next crisis forces it to. The paradox of systemic reform. Everyone agrees that financial systems need reform until it's time to actually change them. That's the paradox Soros explores. The system is flawed, but those who benefit the most from it are also the ones in control, making meaningful reform nearly impossible. As every time a financial crisis exposes deep-rooted problems, Governments and institutions scramble to put out the fire with short-term fixes instead of addressing the structural issues. They act like mechanics trying to patch up an old engine instead of replacing the faulty parts. The problem is that these quick fixes only delay the inevitable. Without real reform, markets remain vulnerable, and sooner or later, another crisis will come along, often worse than the last. However, change is never easy, especially when the system resists it. Soros argues that true reform requires a shift in thinking, an acknowledgement that financial markets are not self-correcting, and that intervention is sometimes necessary to prevent catastrophic failures. The key is to approach reform gradually, ensuring that policies evolve without disrupting economic growth. The goal shouldn't be to eliminate risk entirely, that's impossible, but to create a system that can absorb shocks without collapsing. If we keep repeating the cycle of crisis, reaction, and temporary recovery, we're just setting ourselves up for even bigger disasters in the future. The challenge is not just about fixing what's broken, but about building something stronger in its place. The crash of 87. This chapter invites us to reflect on an event that not only disrupted financial markets, but also reveals the depths of human psychology. October 19, 1987, Black Monday, a day when the financial world stood still as stock markets around the globe plummeted in a matter of hours, with billions of dollars vanishing into thin air, leaving investors in shock. What caused it? Some blamed computerized trading, while others pointed to excessive speculation. Yet Soros saw something deeper at play, as the crash was a textbook case of reflexivity in action investors feeding off each other's fears, triggering a downward spiral that no one could stop. Markets aren't rational, he reminds us, as they are driven by emotion. Once panic sets in, logic goes out the window, and what starts as a market correction can quickly turn into full-blown collapse. What's even more troubling is that these crashes aren't just flukes. They're part of a pattern, with financial markets built on cycles of euphoria and panic, forming bubbles when optimism runs wild and bursting when reality catches up. While regulators introduced circuit breakers and other safeguards after 1987 to prevent a repeat, Soros warns that these measures are like putting a Band-Aid on a much deeper wound. The real issue is that markets will always be vulnerable to extreme swings, as long as human psychology drives financial decision-making. The lesson from Black Monday isn't just about preventing future crashes. It's about recognizing that the system itself is flawed. And without acknowledging this, we're doomed to repeat history, again and again.